Reading from Startide Rising, the last set of chapters in this novel by David Brin. Chapter 118, Streaker. The ambush at the gas giant was unexpected. The enemy came in close, using the great planet's gravity to swing about in a tight hyperbolic turn. They were unprepared for an attack on their flanks. Compared with their breakneck dive, Streaker was almost motionless. She fell upon the pair of cruisers as they passed, lacing a web-like tracery of antimatter in their paths. One of the battleships blossomed into a fireball before Streaker's computers could even identify it. Its screens were probably already damaged after weeks of battle. The other cruiser was in better shape. Its screens flashed an ominous violet, and thin lines of exploding metal brightened its hull, but it passed through the trap and began decelerating furiously.
"It'll miss our mines, worse luck," Tisht announced. "There wasn't time to lay a perfect pattern."
"We can't have everything," Jillian replied. "You handled that brilliantly. He'll be some time getting back to us." Tisht peered at the screen and listened to her neural link. "He may be very tardy. If his engines keep missing, he's on a collision spiral with the planet."
"Goody!
Let's leave him and see about the others." Streaker's motion was taking her away from the giant planet toward another group of five unrushing cruisers. Having witnessed part of the ambush, these were all adjusting course furiously.
"Now we see how well the Trojan Seahorse works," Jillian said. "The first bunch was close enough to read our engines and know we're Earth-made, but these guys were too far back. Hesuesi altered our power output along Thenedon lines as planned."
Watasetti whistled confirmation.
"It's done. Suesi says it'll cut efficiency, though. He reminds you that our engines aren't Thenedon."
"Thank him for me. Now, for all our lives, what happens next depends on whether they're an unimaginative lot, as Tom guessed they'd be."
"Full power to the psi shields."
"Aye, sir."
Energy detectors lit up as the oncoming ships swept them with probe beams. The motley assortment of approaching ED vessels seemed to hesitate, then diverged.
"Numbers 1, 4, and 5 are accelerating to pass us by," Tisht announced. The bridge was filled with chattering dolphin applause.
"What about the others?"
Tisht's manipulator arm pointed to 2 dots in the holotank. "Decelerating and preparing for battle. We're picking up a beam cast in Galactic 10. It's a ritual challenge."
Tisht shook her head.
"They do think we're Thenanin, but they want to stop and finish us off."
"Who are they?"
"Brothers of the Night."
The magnification screens showed the 2 approaching battle wagons, dark and deadly and growing nearer.
"What to do?"
Jillian kept her face impassive. She knew the Fen were watching her.
"We can't outrun them, especially not while we're faking Thenanin engines or wearing this heavy Thenanin shell. But only a fool would try to take them in a straight battle."
"A fighting fool like Tom," she thought ironically, "or Kredaki. If either of them were in command, I'd be preparing condolence wreaths for the Brothers of the Night right now."
"Jillian?" Tisht asked nervously.
Jillian shook herself. "Now, decide now." She looked at the approaching death machines.
"Down their throats," she said. "Head toward Githrop."
Chapter 119, Galactics.
"We shall leave 1/2 of our joint fleet above the planet. None of the others will dare return now that we have consolidated. We shall also send squadrons to clean the moons of hiding enemies and to investigate the happenings out beyond the gas giant."
The Tandu Stalker had only 4 legs now instead of the former 6. The Soro Krat wondered what accident had befallen the leader of her unpleasant allies. Not that it really mattered. Krat dreamt of the day when she could personally detach the stalker's remaining limbs and then all of its head buds.
Is it possible that that outplanet chaos may be caused by the quarry? She asked.
The Tandu's expression was unreadable on the display screen.
All things are possible, even the impossible.
It sounded like a Tandu truism.
But the quarry could not escape even the stragglers' small might. If they are captured by them, the remnants will fight over the spoils. When our task force arrives, we will take over. It is simple.
Krat nodded. It did sound elegant.
Soon, she told herself, soon we will wring the information out of the Earthlings or sift it out of their wreckage. And soon thereafter, we will be before our ancestors themselves. I must try to make certain some few of the humans and dolphins are left alive after they tell us where the progenitor fleet is located. My clients do not appreciate it when I use them for entertainment. It would save trouble if I found amusements outside the family. Wistfully, she longed for a scrappy male of her own species as a joint Tandu-Soro detachment of 13 ships blasted at full thrust toward the gas giant planet.
Chapter 120, Streaker.
Damage to the stasis flanges on the port side, Watasetti announced. All missile slots in that sector are out.
Any harm to the inner hull? Jillian asked anxiously. The Finn looked blank as he sounded out the damage control computer.
Nope. The Thenanit shell taken it all so far, but Suessi says the bracings are weakening.
They'll try to concentrate fire on the port side now that it's damaged, Tish said, and they'll expect us to turn away.
Starboard missile batteries, fire mines at 40 degrees azimuth by 100 south, slow thrust and lurk fuses.
But no one's there.
They will be. Fire!
Helm, roll ship left 2 radians per minute, pitch up 1 per minute.
Streaker shuddered and groaned as she turned slowly in space. Her screens flickered dangerously under powerful battle beams she could never hope to match. Not a blow had been struck on her opponents. They kept up easily with her lumbering attempts at evasion. From Streaker's shadowed quarter, 6 small missiles puffed lazily outward, then cut thrust. Streaker turned to try to protect her weakened side a little more slowly than she was really capable of turning. Sensing a fatal weakness, the enemy battleships followed the turn. Beams stabbed out to blast at Streaker's damaged side at what the Brothers of the Night thought was their supine enemy's real hull. Streaker shook as the beams penetrated her shields and struck the Thenanin armor. Stasis flickered, giving them all eerily vivid feelings of déjà vu. Even in the water-filled bridge, the blasts nearly threw the crew from their stations. Damage control spotters screamed reports of smoke and fire, of melting armor and buckling walls. The cruisers drifted confidently into the mined region, and the missiles exploded. Jillian clutched a handrail whitely. On those sensors that had not been blasted to vapor, the enemy was hidden by a cloud of roiling gas.
Hard thrust! 20 degrees by 270, Tish called. Stop, roll, and pitch!
The abused engines struggled. The bracings holding Streaker to her armored shell groaned as she accelerated in a new direction.
Blessings on that damned Thenanin armor, one of the Finns sighed. Those beams would have sliced Streaker like toast.
Jillian peered into one of the few operational holotanks, straining to see through the space smoke and debris. Finally, she saw the enemy.
A hit! A palpable hit!" she exulted.
One of the battle wagons bore a gaping hole in its side, burning metal still curled away from the cavity, and secondary explosions shook the cruiser. The other one appeared undamaged, but more wary than before.
"Oh, keep hesitating," she urged them silently. "Let us get a head start."
"Anybody else around?" she asked Tisht. If these two ships were the only ones left, she'd be willing to turn the engines back on full power and let even the devil know they were an Earth ship. The lieutenant blinked.
"Yes, Jillian, 6 more, approaching rapidly."
Tisht shook her head.
"There's no way we'll get away from this new bunch. They're coming too fast. Sorry, Jillian."
"The brothers have made up their minds," Wataseti announced. "They're coming after us." Tisht rolled her eyes. Jillian silently agreed. "We won't fool them again."
"Suessi calls. He wants to know if..."
Jillian sighed. "Tell Hannes there don't seem to be any more female tricks forthcoming. I'm fresh out of ideas." The two battleships drew nearer, chasing Streaker's stern. They held their fire, saving it for the final assault. Jillian thought about Tom. She couldn't help feeling that she had failed him.
"It really was a good plan, hon. I only wish I'd executed it competently for you."
The enemy bore down on them, looming ominously. Then Lucky Ka shouted,
"Vector change!"
The pilot's tail thrashed. "They're veering off, fleeing like mullet!" Jillian blinked in confusion.
"But they had us!" "It's the newcomers, Jillian, those 6 oncoming ships!"
Tisht shouted joyfully.
"What? What about them?"
Tisht grinned as broadly as a neophin could manage.
"They're Thedanin! They're coming in blasting, and it's not us they're shooting at!"
The screen showed the pair of cruisers that had been chasing them, now in full flight, firing Parthian style at the approaching mini-flotilla. Jillian laughed.
"Wataseti! Tell Suessi to shut down! Put everything on idle and pour out smoke! We want to play the gravely wounded soldier."
After a moment came the engineer's reply.
"Suessi says that will be no problem. No problem at all."
Chapter 121, Galactics. Bolt's crest riffled with waves of emotion. Krondor's fire lay ahead of them, battered but proud. He had thought the old battle wagon lost since the first day of the battle, and Baron Ebremsev its commander. Bolt longed to see his old comrade again.
"Is there still no response?" he asked the communicator.
"No, commander. The ship is silent. It is possible they just now sustained a fatal blow that..."
"Wait, there is something.
A flashing light signal in uncoded open talk. They are sending from one of the viewing ports."
Bolt edged forward eagerly.
"What do they say? Do they require help?"
The communications officer huddled before his monitor, watching the winking lights, jotting notes.
"All weapons and communications destroyed," he recited. "Life support and auxiliary drives still serviceable. Earthlings ahead, chased by a few dregs. We shall withdraw. Happy hunting. Krondor's fire out."
Bolt thought the message a little odd. Why would Ebremsev want to pull out if he could still follow and at least draw fire from the enemy? Perhaps he was making a brave show in order not to hold them back. Bolt was about to insist on sending aid anyway when the communications officer spoke again.
"Commander, a squadron is outbound from the water planet, at least 10 vessels. I read signs of both Tandu and Sorrow."
Bolt's crest momentarily collapsed. It had come to pass, the very last alliance of heretics.
"We have one chance, after the fugitives at once. We can overpower the remnants even as they overpower the Earthlings, and be off before the Tandu and Soro arrive."
As his ship leapt outward, he had a message sent back to Cronder's fire. "May the great ghosts dwell with you."
Chapter 122, Streaker.
"That's a pretty sophisticated little computer you've kept hidden away all this time," Tisht commented. Jillian smiled. "It's actually Tom's."
The Finns nodded wisely. That was explanation enough.
Jillian thanked the NIS machine for its hurry-up Thenanin translation. The disembodied voice whispered from a cluster of sparkles that floated near her, dancing and whirling amidst the fizzing oxywater bubbles.
"I could do nothing else, Jillian Baskin," it replied. "You few lost Earthlings have accumulated in the course of heaping disasters upon yourselves more data than my masters have gathered in the last 1,000 years. The lessons about uplift alone will profit the Timbrimi, who are always willing to learn, even from wolflings."
The voice faded, and the sparkles vanished before Jillian could reply.
"The signal parties returned from the viewport, Jillian," Tisht said. "The Thenanin have gone off chasing our shadows, but they'll be back. What do we do now?"
Jillian felt tremors of adrenaline reaction she had not planned beyond this point. There was only one thing she wanted desperately to do now, only one destination in the universe she wanted to go.
"Githrop," she whispered.
Jillian shook herself.
"Githrop?"
She looked at Tisht, knowing what the answer would be, wishing it weren't so. Tisht shook her head.
"There's a flotilla orbiting Githrop now, Jillian. No fighting. There must have been a winner in the big battle."
"Another squadron's heading this way fast. A big one. We don't want 'em to get close enough to see through our disguise."
Jillian nodded. Her voice didn't want to function, but she made the words come.
"North," she said. "Take us out along Galactic North, Tisht. On to the transfer point. Full speed. When we get close enough, we'll dump the Seahorse and get the Ifni damned hell out of here with the ashes we've won."
The dolphins returned to their posts. The rumble of the engines gathered strength. Jillian swam to one dark corner of the crystal dome, to a place where there was a chink in the Thenanin armor, where she could look at the stars directly.
Streaker picked up speed.
Chapter 123, Galactics. The Tandu Soro detachment was gaining on the strung-out fugitives.
"Mistress, a crippled Thenanin is approaching the transfer point on an escape trajectory."
Krat squirmed on her cushion and snarled. "So? Casualties have left the battle area before. All sides try to evacuate their wounded. Why do you bother me when we are even now closing in?"
The little Pila detector officer scuttled back into its cubbyhole. Krat bent to watch her forward screens.
A small squadron of Thenanin struggled to keep ahead. Further on, at the edge of detection, sparks of desultory battle showed that the leaders were still bickering, even as they closed on the quarry.
"What if they're mistaken?" Krat wondered. "We chase the Thenanin, who chase the remnants, who chase... what? Those fools might even be chasing each other."
It didn't matter. Half the Tandu Soro fleet orbited Githrop, so the Earthlings were trapped one way or another.
"We'll deal with the Tandu in good time," she thought, "and meet the Ancient Ones alone."
"Mistress!" the Pila shouted shrilly. "There is a transmission from the transfer point!"
"Bother me one more time with inconsequentials," she rumbled, flexing her mating claw threateningly.
But the client interrupted her. The pill dared to interrupt. "Mistress, it is the Earth ship. They taunt us. They defy us. They..."
"Show me," Krat hissed. "It must be a trick. Show me at once."
The pill ducked back into its section. On Krat's main screen appeared the holo-image of a man and several dolphins. From the man's shape, Krat could tell it was a female, probably their leader.
"Stupid creatures, unworthy of the name Sophonts, foolish, pre-sentient upspring of errant masters, we slip away from all your armored might, laughing at your clumsiness. We slip away as we always will, you pathetic creatures, and now that we have a real head start, you'll never catch us. What better proof that the progenitors favor not you, but us? What better proof?"
The taunt went on. Krat listened, enraged, yet at the same time savoring the artistry of it. "These men are better than I'd thought. Their insults are wordy and overblown, but they have talent. They deserve honorable, slow deaths."
"Mistress! The Tandu with us are changing course. Their other ships are leaving Kathrup for the transfer point."
Krat hissed in despair.
"After them! After them at once! We followed them through space this far. The chase only goes on."
The crew bent their tasks resignedly. The Earth ship was in a good position to escape. At best, this would be a long chase. Krat realized that she would never make it home in time for mating. She would die out here. On her screen, the man continued to taunt them.
"Librarian," she called, "I do not understand some of the man's words. Find out what that phrase, nya nya, means in their beastly wolfling tongue."
Chapter 124, Tom Orley. Cross-legged on a woven mat of reeds, shaded by a floating wreck, he listened as a muttering volcano slowly sputtered into silence. Contemplating starvation, he listened to the soft, wet sounds of the endless weedscape, and found in them a homely beauty. The squishy, random rhythms blended into a backdrop for his meditation. On the mat in front of him, like a focus mandala, lay the message bomb he had never set off. The container glistened in the sunlight of North Kithrup's first fine day in weeks. Highlights shone in dimpled places where the metal had been battered, as he had been. The dented surface gleamed still. "Where are you now?" The subsurface sea waves made his platform undulate gently. He floated in a trance through levels of awareness, like an old man poking idly through his attic, like an old-time hobo looking with mild curiosity through the slats of a moving boxcar. "Where are you now, my love?" He recalled a Japanese haiku from the 18th century by the great poet Yoza Buson. "As the spring rains fall, soaking in them on the roof is a child's rag ball." Watching blank images in the dents on the side globe, he listened to the creaking of the flat jungle, its skittering little animal sounds, the wind riffling through the wet, flat leaves. "Where is that part of me that has departed?" He listened to the slow pulse of a world ocean, watched patterns in the metal, and after a while, in the reflections in the dents and creases, an image came to him. A blunt, bulky wedge shape approached a place that was a not place, a shining blackness in space. As he watched, the bulky thing cracked open, the thick carapace slowly split apart like a hatching egg, The shards fell away, and there remained a slender, nubbed cylinder, looking a bit like a caterpillar. Around it glowed a nimbus, a thickening shell of probability that hardened even as he watched. No illusion, he decided. It cannot be an illusion. He opened himself to the image, accepting it, and from the caterpillar a thought winged to him. Blossoms on the pear, and a woman, in the moonlight, reads a letter there. His slowly healing lips hurt as he smiled. It was another haiku by Buzon. Her message was as unambiguous as could be under the circumstances. She had somehow picked up his trance poem and responded in kind. "Jill," he cast as hard as he could. The caterpillar shape, sheathed in a cocoon of stasis, approached the great hole in space. It dropped forward toward the nut place, grew transparent as it fell, then vanished. For a long time, Tom sat very still, watching the highlights on the metal globe slowly shifting as the morning passed. Finally, he decided it wouldn't do him or the universe any harm if he started doing something about survival. Chapter 125, The Skiff. "Between you two crazy males, have you come any closer to figuring out what he's talking about?" Kipiru and Sahat just stared back at Hikaki. They turned back to their discussion without answering her, huddling with Kredeki, trying to interpret the captain's convoluted instructions. Hikaki rolled her eyes and turned to Toshio. "You'd think they'd include me in these seances of theirs. After all, Kredeki and I are mates." Toshio shrugged. Kredeki needs Sahat's language skill and Kipiru's ability as a pilot. But you saw their faces. They're halfway into the whale dream right now. We can't afford to have you that way while you're in command. Hikaki spumed, only slightly mollified. "I suppose you've finished the inventory, Toshio?" "Yes, sir," he nodded. "I have a written list ready. We're well enough stocked in consumables to last to the first transfer point, and at least one beyond that. Of course, we're in the middle of nowhere, so we'll need at least 5 transfer jumps to get anywhere near civilization. Our charts are pitifully inadequate. Our drives will probably fail over the long haul, and few ships our size have even taken transfer points successfully. Aside from all that, and the cramped living quarters, I think we're all right." Hikaki sighed. "We can't lose anything by trying. At least the galactics are gone." "Yeah," he agreed. "It was a nice stroke, Jillian taunting the Edies at the last minute. It let us know they got away and got the Edies off our backs." "Don't say Edies, Toshio. It's not polite. You may offend some nice Canton or Linton one day if you get into the habit." Toshio swallowed and ducked his head. No matter where or when, no lieutenant had ever been known to slacken off on a MIDI. "Yes, sir," he said. Hikaki grinned and flicked a small splash of water on the youth with her lower jaw. "Duty, duty, brave shark biter. What reward could taste better?" Toshio blushed and nodded. The skiff started to move again. Kipiru was back in the pilot's saddle. Kredeki and Sahat chattered excitedly in a semi-primal rhythm which still sent shivers down Hikaki's spine, and Sahat had said that Kredeki was toning it down on purpose. She was still getting used to the idea that Kredeki's injury might have been a door opening rather than a closing. The skiff lifted from the sea and began to speed eastward, following Kredaki's hunch. "What about passenger morale?" Hikahi asked Toshio. "Well, I guess it's all right. That pair of Kikui are happy, so long as they're with Denny. And Denny's happy. Well, she's happy enough for now." Hikahi was amused. Why should the youth be embarrassed about Denny's other preoccupation? She was glad the two young humans had each other, as she had Kredaki. In spite of this new, eerie side, Kredaki was the same dolphin. The newness was something he used, something he seemed only to have begun exploring. He could hardly speak, but he conveyed his great intellect and his caring in other ways. "What about Charlie?" she asked Toshio. Toshio sighed. "He's still embarrassed." They had found the chimp a day after the great earthquakes, clinging to a floating tree trunk, sopping wet. He had been unable to speak for 10 hours and had kept climbing the walls in the skiff's tiny hold until he finally calmed down. Charlie finally admitted that he had scrambled to the top of a tall tree just before the island blew. It had saved his life, but the stereotype mortified him. Toshio and Hikahi crowded in behind Kipiru's station and watched as the ocean rolled swiftly beneath the skiff. For minutes at a time, the sea turned a brilliant green as they passed over great swatches of vine. The little boat sped toward the sun. They had been searching for almost a week, ever since Streaker had departed. First found had been Toshio, swimming purposefully westward, never giving up. Then Denny had led them to another island where there was a tribe of Kikui. While she negotiated another treaty, they searched for and found Charles Dart. Takata Jim's Stenos were all missing or dead. After that had come one last and apparently forlorn search. They had been at this last phase for several days now. Hikahi was about to give up. They couldn't go on wasting time and consumable like this, not with the journey they had ahead of them. Not that they really had much of a chance. No one had ever heard of a voyage like they planned. A cross-galactic journey in the skiff would make Captain Bly's epic crossing of the Pacific in the Bounty's longboat seem like an afternoon jaunt. She kept her appraisal to herself, though. Kredaki and Kipiru probably understood what lay ahead of them. Toshio seemed to have guessed part of it already. There was no reason to inform the others until they had to cut the rations for the fourth time. She sighed. Of what else are heroes made than men and women who, like us, try? Kipiru's fluting call of triumph was like a shrill trumpet. He squalled and tossed on his platform. The skiff rolled left and right in a wiggle-waggle, then went into a screaming climb. "What the f—" Toshio stopped himself. "Holy jumping turtlefish, Kipiru, what is it?" Hikahi used a harness arm to grab a wall stanchion and looked out a port. She sighed for a third time, long and deep. The smoke from his fire momentarily hid the boat from sight. The first he knew of it was the sonic boom that rolled over him, nearly knocking over his drying racks. The human standing on the woven reed mat almost dove for cover, but a hunch made him stop and look up instead. His eyes were sun-squinted. Crow's feet that had not been there a few weeks before lay at the corners. His beard was black with thin gray flecks. It had grown out and nearly stopped itching, almost covering a ragged scar that ran down one cheek. Shading his eyes, he recognized the wild maneuvers before he did the outlines of the tiny ship. It streaked high into the sky and looped about, coming back to screech past him again.
He reached out to steady the drying racks against the thunder. No sense in letting the meat go to waste. It had taken a lot of work to harvest it, strip it, and prepare it. They might need it for the voyage ahead. He wasn't sure how the Fen would take to the stuff, but it was nourishing, the only food on the planet that an Earthling could eat. Gubru jerky, tendu strips, and flayed episiarch would never make it into haute cuisine, of course, but perhaps they were an acquired taste. He grinned and waved as Kipiru finally calmed down enough to bring the skiff to a halt nearby. How could I ever have doubted he'd still be alive? Hikahi wondered joyfully. Jillian said he had to live. None of the Galactics could ever touch him. How could they? And why in the wide universe was I ever worried about getting home? Epilogue. Rest, rest and listen. Rest and listen and learn, Kraideki. For the star tide rises in the currents of the dark, and we have waited long for what must be.